Did you have anything come up in the break that you wanted to talk about before we jump back into the text?
I had a question that didn't come up in the break, but I thought it should break.
Sure.
And that is, Buddhism deal with opinion on things that happen, like when you have sort of clairvoyant things happen to you, or when you hear someone speaking to you, or you get messages from somebody who's not with us anymore.
Mm-hmm. Involuntary ESP, the random things, any number of things could be happening. We totally do talk about those things in Buddhism, and you would have to kind of talk about it case by case to identify what's going on in each situation. In the case of hearing people who have passed away, there are kind of two possibilities. One is that actual person has taken rebirth in a hungry ghost realm and are trying to communicate.
What realm, sorry?
Hungry ghost. And there are, you know, just like humans, there are degrees of suffering within that realm. Some of them aren't suffering as much as others, and some are actually able to do some work still. You know, then there's also the case that it's a being in that realm who has a level of clairvoyance and can see your mind and see your memories and is being either helpful or mischievous. So they're either trying to communicate with you in order to get you to do something, and they're being mischievous and naughty, or they're trying to communicate with you to try and bring you comfort. And so it could be the person that actually passed away, but it's actually probably more likely that it's a being in another realm who is either trying to comfort you or mischievous. And so the advice my teacher often gives is, you know, apply your own critical thinking. Really, you know, like, don't just assume it really is that person. Because they can, you know, a lot of these beings can see your mind, can see your memories, and can even take the form of that loved one if you've got the merit to see them. So, you know, a lot of things could be happening. You know, we also believe that there are a lot of beings in other realms that inhabit the environment, like deities of the elements, or deities that might live around trees or in sort of sacred sites. We would call these like landlord spirits. And I'm sure Aboriginal folks talk about something similar. They would describe it slightly differently. But the idea that it's best not to disrupt certain areas because they're sacred sites, we would say that as well. You know, if you have to go somewhere that you know is like an Aboriginal sacred site, for example, we would really say, in your mind, really be respectful and be asking permission and saying, I'm coming in now, I hope it's okay, I really don't mean any disrespect, you know, but to really go in with that awareness that there are landlord deities. And these aren't Buddhas, they're just, you know, progressed on the path to a certain extent and have some really strong karmic connection with a place. And so, you know, sometimes when we ourselves personally have little flashes of clairvoyance, little flashes of being aware of what people are thinking or what's going to happen next, or yeah, or even, you know, the weird deja vu thing, or any of those kind of minor clairvoyances, especially ones that we don't have control over, they seem to just come in. People have that experience of going to pick up the phone and then it rings, you know, that one happens quite regularly to most people. Or you pick up the phone and you know it's your mother before she begins to speak, you know, that sort of,
yeah,
that kind of mild clairvoyance. That is just abilities that you developed many lifetimes ago that have kind of worn out a little bit and you haven't reinvigorated, but still are a little bit with you. So they're popping out from old habit, but in this life you haven't necessarily cultivated them or gotten a good control over them, and so they'll come out in a more random way. And so, you know, there are tons of degrees of clairvoyance, some very minor that a lot of us experience and some more kind of intense. So, you know, if you go to a flaky tarot card reader, they might actually have some level of clairvoyance, but it's going to be on this worldly level and somewhat reliable, but not necessarily as reliable as they'd have you think. You know, so they might be able to see a little bit what's going to happen or be able to read trends that your mind and the karma that's ripening for you is happening. But again, you know, always apply that kind of skepticism, you know.
When you say, look, I had, here's an example, 5 minutes before brakes fail, I get a old gear, I said to my husband,
yeah.
Get in old gear. And then just stuff like that. Should we try and develop that? That's something we're remembering from a past life? Or should we just take it for what it is and leave it? Or, like, some religions would say, well, stay away from it.
But we would say, don't give it too much thought, you know? Like, that stuff just comes up, and sometimes it might not be a clairvoyance from your side. It might be that you have an opening to being helped, and some Buddha is going, "Oi, Catherine, tell him!" You know, and you're actually being helped by some external force, whether an enlightened force or someone on the way to enlightenment. So, you know, I personally, you know, if you notice that you do have some maybe small clairvoyance, being able to kind of assess what's going on for people, if your motivation is kind. You know, and if your motivation is to benefit others and not to just, like, find out people's secrets or, like, curiosity or whatever, that is worth kind of pursuing a little bit. But you want to be careful because there are beings out there that are a lot more powerful than us. And, you know, if you kind of enter into their realms of operation, we could piss them off and not know what to do about that. You know, so at the end of the day, it's probably better to just go, oh, that was interesting. Huh. You know, that was interesting. And not to worry about it too much. You know, it's not something to be afraid of, but it's also not something to put too much energy into. And, you know, and when people hear their loved ones, you know, after they've passed away, you know, really take it with a grain of salt. It could be the loved one. It could be a spirit trying to comfort you. Or it could be someone trying to cause mischief. You know, just send that loved one compassion and come back to the present. So, we do talk about these things. I mean, we talk about things like schizophrenia, you know, when people really hear voices. From a Buddhist perspective, they actually are hearing voices. Those are actual beings. And there's an interesting, you know, kind of new study about how lots of people who suffer from schizophrenia smoke cigarettes, and it helps kind of relieve their symptoms. And from a scientific perspective, people think that it's the chemicals in the cigarettes, you know, kind of help subdue some of the chemical imbalances that cause these voices. From a Buddhist perspective, they've always thought that these beings are what we call smell eaters. And so if you're smoking, it kind of placates them and it makes them chill out. So, you know, there's different ways to read these same kind of symptoms, you know, in whatever way works for you. But to, you know, not assume that crazy people are actually crazy, they might actually be hearing something, and you know, to kind of give them that compassion and that respect of they have some mild level of clairvoyance that's actually quite disruptive to their life, you know, and is actually causing them a lot of grief and suffering, you know. So there's a lot of different ways to approach this stuff, but certainly it's talked about.
Does Buddhism also just, like, kind of give credit to the fact that maybe they are not crazy, but, like, they have something wrong in the wiring of their brain? Schizophrenics really have an organic thing that's
going
wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes they there's the sort of three humors in Tibetan medicine. You know, bile and wind and phlegm. You know, and when these things are out of balance, the mind is affected. And so sometimes people who do very deep retreat will disturb the sort of humors within their body and develop symptoms of mental illness for brief periods of time, like paranoia. Because they've disrupted these internal systems. So there's a physical relationship to what's going on with their body. So when they were meditating, you know, it's a mental thing, but maybe they were too tight or pushing, and they created kind of knots in these energy systems. You know, sometimes you get that tightness in your chest or that, like, pit in your stomach, like when there's anxiety or there's fear happening. Sometimes you can actually generate that by pushing too hard in your meditation, and there will be a mental impact to that. And it's not forever, and, you know, you can get over it. You just need to relax and, you know, eat nice heavy food and look at the sea and, you know, get some space in there, and it'll go away. But so there, you know, there is a connection between the body and the mind and some of these severe mental illnesses that have a really obvious organic basis. Tibetans would say, yes, there is something physical going on, but there's often more than something physical going on. You know, maybe that physical thing gives them a receptivity to being aware of other things. Who can say? So you take it case by case. And you know, and there's sometimes practices you can do to kind of clear that, you know. So in Tibet, you know, people with schizophrenia, if they have the sort of voices that are very scary and harmful, often the lamas in the area will do big practices for them and try and clear and move on those spirits, and then they're cured. You know, it's like from a Western perspective, we'd say, oh, they don't have schizophrenia anymore. How did that happen? You know, when in fact the voices, the beings have actually been moved on. So who can say why that happens, you know? And that's kind of the realm of things that I don't put a lot of energy into, because it's hard to kind of quantify and see how it all works. But in terms of my own experience, you know, definitely these lamas are able to see what you're thinking and to see kind of your level of mind and be able to say, this practice will work better than that practice based on your level, you know? So in terms of our own practice, you know, that's probably as much as we need to go into, is to really know that the value of a teacher is they're able to be so specific, you know? And
what about people who say to you that there are evil entities in your house and that you need to do cleansing things? And
yeah, and you know, some of those people are totally flaky and some of them are reading something. And it could be that there are some, you know, entities that are disturbed, you know.
So we need to protect ourselves in any other way other than meditation when you ask for, you know, the holy beings to be present.
Really, that's plenty, you know, to sort of say, Buddhas, I think there's someone around who is not happy. Can you protect this house? Also, you know, you can sort of give, if you have a sense of there's something in this house, a sort of feeling, which does happen to us sometimes, you can sort of be talking to them and say, I'm really apologetic if I've disturbed your space, and if the building of this house, often when you build new houses and clear land, that's what really disrupts things, and to say, you know, I'm very sorry if we've disrupted the land, I really apologize. And sometimes people will, like, you know, make them a little cake and put it outside and say, this is for you, I'm so sorry, you know, make them a cake, placate them with cake. You know, and it's quite a traditional practice. And sometimes it helps. And things like, you know, smudging with sage or incense, you know, if you think you're offering this lovely smell, you know, and saying, you know, I mean you no harm. And often beings that have been disrupted are evil. They're just grumpy because they've been disrupted. So if you can kind of have that, there's no need to be afraid. They can't hurt you, especially if you're connecting with holy beings. But they're suffering, you know, and they're sort of feeling disrupted. And so, you know, offering them that kindness. And whenever you do your practice in a space, it really benefits the beings in the area. And so that's a nice thought. You know, wherever you've been doing your practice is really nice for that area. It sort of blesses the space. And that's why it feels different when you go into, like, well-established Dharma centers, like the one next door has been around maybe 30 years, and you go into their temple and it's kind of like, huh, something, you know, or like churches that are hundreds of years old, you're like, oh, something, you know, that feeling, it's been, the space has been blessed. Here there was a lot of wedding receptions, so I might not have that vibe yet, but give it time, but you know what I'm saying, so, yeah, it's all interesting, you know, I think the danger is that we could get too superstitious, and it's important not to, you know, to know, yep, there are beings that we can't see, but we can't see them, so, you know, operate with the ones you can see, and when you have a sense of stuff being around, to just send it kindness, because that's what all sentient beings want, that these beings are not really that much different to us, and that we have been in those states ourselves many times, and so you don't need to have that kind of fear. More like it's someone you haven't met yet who is suffering in a way that you do too, and just send the love. So, like that. Like that. Does that make sense? That trigger anyone? No? It's all good? Okay. So, we'll go down to number 3, transforming adverse circumstances into the path of enlightenment. And the main bullet point there is, when the world is filled with negativities, transform adverse circumstances into the path to enlightenment. Number 3. Number 3. So this is really the call to arms to use difficulties as fuel for the practice. So, you know, to really think any positive trait that you have probably came about through some difficulty. You know, if you have patience, it's because you've met with difficult people or circumstances. You know, if you have loving kindness and compassion, there have been things around that have helped nurture that. And so when the world is filled with negativities, or when you're surrounded by disturbing forces or unkind people or angry people or people in distress, this is the great opportunity for practice. And this is what will sort of force your mind into new habits. Because when everything is comfortable, we get complacent. You know, when everything is comfortable, there's no need. You know, there's no need to work on your practice because why change things? If it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know? So, you know, when things are really difficult, this is the time when it reminds us, oh, the spiritual path, you know? When things are very rosy, we get very lazy. So to really value difficult times, because these are the times when growth happens. And, you know, again, you don't get masochistic and, like, seek out difficulties. But, you know, to really look at the difficulties that happen, even if it's a little disruption in your relationship, a little argument here, you know, a little, you know, sort of obstacle there, you know, you've got the plan for the day and then something interrupts it, to not see these things as problems, to see them as opportunities for practice. And, you know, you don't want to get flaky about it and sort of, you know, like, it's all good, everyone's my teacher, you know, like, you don't get too flaky about it. Really, it's an honest assessment of good qualities come from stress, you know? Not necessarily, like, stress could just make us bitter, stress could just make us cynical, but there's great potential in stressful instances for us to develop and open our hearts. So that's really the meaning of this point. Do you reckon that's true, or are you feeling like, nah?
Well, in the management, there is a healthy level of stress which increases your performance.
Mm.
If it is less than that, as you say, people are complacent.
Yep.
If it is more than that, then they
burn
troubles
out
to cope. That's right. They burn out and so on. So it's, as always, and as everything, it's about the balance.
Yeah. Yeah. But no stress means kind of no work, doesn't it? And even in terms of like what kind of rebirth we want, we do believe in these sort of like godlike realms, a bit how the Greek gods are described. So they have personalities and scenarios and lives and whatever, and they're very powerful and very beautiful, and it takes them a long time to age. But we don't really want to be born in one of those areas because it's so peaceful that there's not much impetus to do anything about it, and we're just using up our positive karma. We're just using it up. So. Similarly, you know, like with animals that are very, you know, pampered, they're using tons of merit, you know, they're using tons of their positive karma and not creating much new, you know. So stress is not necessarily a bad thing. Yes. And yet, yes, if there is extreme stress, then of course burnout is the potential. But if you can get into that mindset of, ah, opportunity to practice, you know, or difficult person, ah, my teacher. You know, and that is sort of a subtle insult in the Buddhist community. If you say to someone, oh, you're my teacher, you know, it's like you're teasing them. You're sort of saying you're being very difficult. you know, you're my teacher. So, you know, it grain of salt. But to really think like these difficult people are the basis for our developing qualities. And, you know, if we handle difficult situations well, it's because we've developed a habit of being able to do so. These things don't come out of thin air. People don't have, you know, strong characters or amazing qualities just by themselves, right? They come from being sort of rubbed with sandpaper is how we get smooth, right? So, okay, so that's the first one. Second one is banish the one to blame for everything. And this is my favorite one. The one to blame for everything is self-cherishing and self-grasping, which we talked about yesterday. So the one to blame for all of your trouble, the one to blame for all of your stress, the one to blame for all of your obstacles is the self-cherishing attitude. And because of the self-cherishing attitude, we know there has been a self-grasping attitude there from the beginning. And so whether it's other people's self-cherishing or your self-cherishing or whatever, this is the cause for all problems in the entire world, right? All wars, all famines, all everything. The one to blame for everything is the self-cherishing thought. And the self-cherishing thought comes from the mistaken idea about how the self exists, the self-grasping, which is the root of cyclic existence. So these two, self-grasping and self-cherishing, do we have kind of a sense of what they are, or are they still a bit vague?
If you can spend a few words on it, it would be good, I guess.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so the master or the instigator is self-grasping. Self-grasping is the misapprehension of self, right? So this is, sometimes old translations call it ego grasping. It's viewing the self or the I in your own mental continuum and holding it to exist inherently. So we do have an I, but we're actually identified with the one that doesn't exist, which is the sort of identity, personality, solid fixed permanent conception of like self or core. This one doesn't actually exist, but it's where we identify. And because of this false relationship we have with how we exist, then there's a sense of me solidly here and mine and what I need to protect, and then you out here who are different and separate. You know, and that's a false view. Of course, we are distinct entities, but we're so interrelated that actually drawing a clear border of where I stop and you begin is not so clear. It's a lot more woven together than it seems. Right now it seems very obvious, me over here, you over there, but actually there's way more connection. So this is the misapprehension of self, this self-grasping. It's grasping at a self that doesn't exist. Now the self that does exist is just that which is merely labeled on the body and mind, or the five aggregates. So that which is merely labeled on the body and mind, that's the self that exists, and it's incredibly subtle. Because it's a something, you know, that body and mind that we're labeling, merely labeling, I onto, are both changing constantly. The body's changing constantly, the mind is changing constantly. They are both influenced by so many different factors. You know, so you say, okay, well, here's my body, it's solid and obvious. But what is it made up of? You know, everything I've ever eaten, right? You know, every sort of air that's ever been around me, the genetics of my parents, you know, the all sorts of bits and pieces. So this body, you know, if you were to point to it, you were pointing to a piece of it, you know? So, oh, is the arm the body? Oh, you know, oh, no, no, this is the body. Oh, is it the shoulders the body then, is it? You know, so were you to, like, find the body amongst the collection of parts, you could not find it. There is no body separate from the collection of parts, just like there is no mind separate from the collection of parts, and there is no self separate from the collection of body and mind. So you can see the self that actually exists is incredibly subtle, right? And yet, we see it as a very solid, permanent thing that's self-generating, and develop all of our afflictions on the basis of that. So because of our self-grasping, we have self-cherishing. And self-cherishing is really holding this particular false self as of primary importance and looking after its needs at the expense of others. Or with indifference to others. And so the root of all trouble in the world are these two. It's the one to blame for everything. Yeah. And even in terms of environmental disasters, karmically we would say that's the natural reflection of these mental states. But it's much more obvious to see just in our family relationships. Whenever there's an argument about anything at all, someone has big self-cherishing manifest. Otherwise there would be no argument, it would be a discussion. You know, so it's really important to look at how this is the source of all the trouble. You know, anytime there's a negative emotion present, you can trace it back to self-cherishing and trace that back to self-grasping every time. Yeah, full stop. What do you think about that? True or not true? Do you see how that would work?
Again, rings a bell. Where I struggle personally is really, I guess, I'm coming back always to the balance. It's difficult to sometimes avoid feeling a victim for, you know, what I perceive as very sacrifices I have done for the other person, and I do not feel any gratitude or respect. I understand that it's exactly, I shouldn't be grateful to anyone and all of that, but it's difficult to get rid of that habit because I have done something for you, so there is an inherent expectation that you will sort of reciprocate back, or you will behave in a similar manner to me. And when I don't see that, I am upset, angry, and all of the above. So I guess that's, after reflecting what we discussed yesterday and today, that seems to me as my key problem.
Well,
how to get rid of that self-cherishing or self-grasping, which is at the bottom of everything.
Well, first I think you need to look at wise selfishness. What is this wise selfishness? And first of all, you know, what you said was, you know, you've done something kind for someone, and so part of you kind of expects some kindness back or some benefit back. And so what we have to ask ourselves first is, what is actually beneficial? So say, you know, you were the one that took out the rubbish, you know, and you did that to benefit the household. And it's not really your turn, but you did it anyway. Okay, so you think that you're doing this thing to benefit others, and then part of you is setting up an expectation that someone is going to do something kind for you. Now, really, like, the things that look like kindness and the things that actually benefit us are different. The things that we like and seem like kindness often are things that placate our ego, feed our arrogance, and make us more stuck in our ways. You know? So if you you think, well, who is benefited by taking out the rubbish? Well, I got the exercise of walking to the bin and back. I got the exercise of carrying this. I removed the stinky thing from the house. So actually, yes, it was nice for the household, but it was nice for me too. So actually, who did I do this for? You know, I did it for myself, and it wound up benefiting other people. Yeah, and so that's good and that's nice, but to notice that there often is a selfish motivation in all of the good things you do, and often the good things you do are wanting some feedback. Either it's just validation or thank you, you're so kind for having done that, you know? And really, is that kindness when people validate you like that? It's feeding your ego, it's feeding your pride, it's feeding that false self. What is more useful is if people call you on your stuff. You know, and kind people who love you. But, you know, if there's two friends in your life, one of them always agrees with you, is always kind to you, always pays the bill, you know, at the restaurant, you know, always makes you laugh. That's the friend that you want to be around. And then say you have another friend who you know respects and loves you, but will call you on your stuff and say, dude, you seemed really lazy this week. You know, all you've done is just sit around and do nothing. And they've called you on it, and that is uncomfortable. You know, and you don't like being sort of your bad traits being shown or being observed. And yet that person who's making you uncomfortable is a lot more valuable a friend than that person that placates you. So you have to take the whole idea of what is beneficial and look at what does that actually mean. You know, this outcome you want from having done the kind thing, actually that outcome isn't necessarily that beneficial to you anyway. You know, and if you go back to that first one of when the world is filled with negativities, take it on the path, well, really, it's when people behave in a difficult way that your qualities develop. So, you know, objectively, you know, if you take your emotions out of it, just sort of objectively, isn't that true?
Yeah, and that's the difficult part, because inevitably you are in it, so
yes.
It's hard to be objective.
And so this is why you need to be objective in times when you're not being confronted in an obvious way, when you're by yourself, when you're on your cushion. For a few minutes, try and be the scientist of your own circumstance, you know, and examine it without objectivity. Because when you're in it, yeah, you're in it, and you're swept up in the false idea of yourself, their self, and the clash, you know. But when you can kind of take yourself away for a few minutes, gather your thoughts, come back to these teachings, reinforce the logic of them, bring in your own past life experiences, you know, from all of the past in this life, and see how difficulties have come from self-cherishing, and try and find different times that conflict has arisen in your life, and see how you can trace it back to those two. Well, then when you go back to your life, it's informed by that wisdom. So the only thing that's going to help give you space between your automatic reaction and this wisdom that you're cultivating is the mindfulness and the repetition of things you've already understood. So you already get these things, obviously, intellectually, but it hasn't come down and become part of your heart. It's not something that you have ownership of, because in heat of the moment, we forget, right? So the only thing to make it move from the brain to the heart is repetition, is meditation.
Is there any specific meditation or prayer which would focus on this particular issue?
Well, I mean, you can read through these just slowly and reflect on each point in a reflective meditation. So, you know, the easiest type of analytical meditation is to pick one of these points, just one, sit with it, identify first what does it mean, then identify what are the benefits of thinking in this way, what are the disadvantages of when I don't. Bring in logic, bring in life experience, dedicate, go back to life. Yeah, so the most straightforward analytical meditation you could do is just to identify what does this point mean, benefits, disadvantages, dedicate, go. And you can do more extensive, you know, structured ones, and there are plenty of books out there that have, you know, longer ones, like that Tonglen meditation I gave you yesterday. There's plenty of, you know, like formulas that you could go to. On the next where is it? There's a compassion meditation under point five that is helpful for these sort of things. So, you know, and it's just a shorty. And there's a book called How to Meditate by Kathleen McDonald, and she has a number of really good analytical meditations. So Kathleen McDonald's book, How to Meditate, is a good go-to for any of these kind of analysis. And then at the end of the day, plain old mindfulness. You know, anything that just brings you back to the present, back to being focused, will help you remember the things that you've learned. You know, we'll forget all of this wisdom we've accumulated if we're swept up in distraction. You know, and so when you're swept up in just getting through the day, the logistics of the day, you're thinking about different work stuff, you're thinking about meal planning, you're thinking about travel issues, when you're just kind of about plans, you're not in this moment, and you forget what you've learned. So anything that's going to bring you back front and center is going to help all of these intellectual understandings come forefront. So you need the two in your practice. You need a little bit of analysis, a little bit of placement. The two. And just slowly, slowly these skills develop. It's just like exercise. You know, slowly, slowly you get stronger. So, you know, you can't expect there to be an impact the same day that you do this meditation, but there might be, actually. There might be. It depends on how deep you went with it, how genuine you went with it. So the thing that makes a meditation a good one is when it's real, you know. If you've just kind of gone through some steps and let it sort of stay up here, it's not of huge benefit. But anytime you have one of these points, and then you think about your life, and think about things that prove that point, and then you use logic, and you think of different logic that proves that point, then that point is not something on the page, it's something you have ownership of. It's yours now.
I guess that's where I struggle to find a different logic, because when I analyze it the way you describe, you know, generally, I'm quite successful. You know, back in Czech Republic, I was earning more than president and prime minister. Similarly, here in Australia, I'm in top layer, a lot of successes in professional career. Yet at home, I do not feel appreciated, and that drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Because everyone else could see that, right?
Yeah.
Only the person
I committed
to spend my life with doesn't see that, right? So that drives me crazy. Frustration and anger. So I have to forget about the point I am a successful professional person. There is obviously something wrong with the way I relate to my wife at home.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm struggling to find it, I guess, extra logic, because the pride in myself is saying you have achieved something, so there must be something right in the way you approach and do things, right? So that's the dilemma I have.
Well, and you know, it sounds like your business life is taken care of. That doesn't need more thought. Your personal life needs more thought. And so these same logical arguments, you have to bring in examples of fights that you've had with your wife and seen how you were wrong. Of course, in a fight, both people are wrong because there's anger. But it doesn't make any difference how she was wrong, because she's not the one you need to change. You're the one you need to change. So who cares if you had superior logic in that argument? You were a little bit wrong because you were angry. That's the sign you were wrong. So who cares who is more right in terms of percentages? Look at your side, only your side, and see how there was self-cherishing involved, and see how that was selfish-based. See how that would have an impact on her, and see how it's not actually logical. Because we have to look at the family unit as an organism. You know, it's not you here and her here. You're the family unit, and so benefiting her benefits you. You know, benefiting her benefits you.
Just thinking with that, like, I get that, you know, you can't expect people to be thankful. Like, the friend that calls you on your things is a much more valuable friend. But at the same time, you kind of want, like, for good qualities is to be appreciative of other people's efforts. So I do get why you're like, I'd be pissed off too. But I think, like, the thing is to approach it in a different way, like you would a child, because if I had a child, I would want them to grow up being appreciative, so I would do things for them. But if they didn't say thank you, I wouldn't get angry, but I would still kind of have that same outward reaction, like even like yelling at them, or not yelling, but like rousing on them. so that they would be appreciated in the future, but it's not affecting me in an angry way internally.
Mm.
It's just somehow that I can get my child to be appreciated to other people so that they benefit other people, and it's, you know, it doesn't come about you, it comes about them. So I guess maybe, yeah, like I get that your wife should be appreciative of things that you do, but don't let it get you angry. Just,
well,
I guess
I'm
trying to appreciate.
Yeah, and I guess there are other elements. Obviously, I'm influenced by the way I was raised by my parents,
mm.
and they were quite different.
Mm.
They really showed appreciation, you know, and focus on the positives, and that's why I inevitably expect something similar from my wife.
But do you have to hear what you're saying there? When you have an expectation, the emotion under expectation is neediness.
I know.
And neediness is
that.
Going to trigger people
yeah.
to withdraw that very thing you want. Even if she does appreciate you, even if she sees all the amazing things you do, if she was about to be appreciative, but you've got this needy energy,
yeah.
she's going to withdraw from that, right?
I do realize that now.
Yeah.
I guess and there is another element which I also struggle, and again, if you have some kind of insight or guidance, my wife has a tendency to be fundamentalist in
mm.
a lot of things. And I do struggle with the notion that I have to work on myself to change myself for the better of the bigger unit, of
mm.
the bigger family, because even if I change myself and she stays a fundamentalist, will I achieve anything? That's
well,
the doubt I have.
But what is your goal? When you say achieve, what is it that you want to achieve? What is
harmony.
This goal? Just harmony. Well,
yeah.
if, you know, lack of harmony means there's two people clashing, right?
Yeah.
If you stop clashing, then there's no more disturbance.
You change your energy. It has
yeah.
an effect on it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. The thing is that I feel like a lot of what you're saying, you know, it sounds like you feel maybe alone in this relationship, like not seen for what you are or something.
Yeah, so.
You know, and there, you know, we'll get to it soon, but we can jump to it, you know. There's another point that says if the two witnesses hold the primary one, or be your own witness, which really means you have to have that self-confidence, which is different than pride, that self-awareness and self-confidence that knows when you have done the right thing and is content with that. And whether she sees it that way or whether she perceives it that way or not won't matter if you have conviction that you've done the right thing. Now, when you give her the power to determine whether or not you're valuable, then already you've lost. You know, already you've given up all of your power, all of your strength. You know, when suddenly she's the one that gets to decide whether you're valuable or not. If you know what you've done is of value, that should be enough. And if it's not enough, you haven't actually brought it down and realized that you've done the right thing. You know, if you think, okay, well, what are the things I think are important from a husband and from a father, you know, and you go through the traits. And sometimes as you go through the list of things you think you're doing right, you might realize that the reason that she's not showing appreciation and value is that those things you're doing aren't the things that are important to her. You know, maybe you're an excellent provider, but she just wants you to be home and hang out because she misses you, you know? Like, you know, you have to look at that. Here's the things that you value and you think you're doing well. If she's not showing appreciation, either you're very needy, so she's withdrawing, or those aren't the things she values.
It's a combination.
Yeah, and so, you know, you have to say, okay, well, these are things I value, but they don't exist from their own side as inherently valuable. So being successful and having money has some value to you, but obviously those things don't have value to
or
everyone.
Just stuff I've read.
You know?
Being a good provider in women's language tends to, men think that counts as a really big thing, and women often tend to count that as one thing. I know it sounds horrible, but on par with putting out the garbage.
Yeah.
Or reading the kids a story or whatever else.
Yeah.
John Gray, there's a whole lot of stuff I've read on. Who's the guy? Even Marvel Venus stuff. I mean, as cliched as that is, that will be pointed out in those books, and I think that's true.
Look, you know, it boils down to if there's too much emotion, neither of you are hearing each other anyway.
Mm.
You know, and so even if you're 90% right and she is, you know, 10% right, still you're 10% wrong there. You know, and so if your emotion needs to be right, then you can't have a conversation. You know, so if you think I'm right, but I'm landing gently on that, you know, I'm right based on my perspective, the way I was brought up, the things that I value. From that perspective, I'm doing the right thing, but I can only see from my experience. I can't see from hers because I'm not her. So I'm going to go into this conversation listening, not trying to prove my point. You know, because that's how arguments get really bad, is that you're going in with your assumption of being right and wanting to prove that. And she's doing the same. You know, whereas if one person's coming into the discussion, okay, I think I'm right, but I might be wrong. There's some gap for listening. The person who's being listened to feels respected. You know, when people are listening to you, you feel respected. And so, you know, show her the respect of listening to what she has to say and really gauging, okay, now that she said that, are there some pieces here that I could take on? You know, you don't force it. Like, if there's things that she's saying that are totally outrageous and rubbish, you don't have to, like, do them. But I'm sure if you listen hard enough, there's a few things that you can tweak, you know, that'll both make her feel listened to and respected. Just little things, you know, and to really do them and be consistent. Could be the smallest of things, but it'll make her feel so good, you know, that you've heard her. And then slowly, you know, the trust kind of comes back, the connection comes back. And then if there's things that she needs to change, she's going to be more receptive to hearing that. But the only thing you can do in terms of a spiritual path for someone else is to model it within yourself. So even you're a parent, right? You can't inflict your values on a child. You can try through discipline and rousing or whatever, but they're just going to do it so they don't get in trouble. The way that it's going to come from them is that they see how you are and they value it.
Leading by example. Leading by example.
Exactly, always. Always, because if it's something that's forced upon them, they might wind up doing it out of fear or whatever, but there's going to be resentment underneath and rebellion later on. So it has to be modeled. So if you want validation, you need to validate. You know, if you want peaceful and calm, you need to be peaceful and calm. You know, so, you know, your wife is not your child, but still you're modeling how you value life. And slowly that's going to have an impact. Because you must have chosen her for some reason. You must love her or you wouldn't be with her. So it's worth a go, you know. If the marriage is over, it's over. But my feeling is that you value it. Otherwise, you wouldn't worry about it so much. So, you know, there must be bits about her that you think are great. You know, so also coming back to what are the things about her that you really value? What are the things about her that you cherish, you know? And it does, it changes your whole energy when you're with her. You know, she's not going to feel that judgment and that oppression and that, you know, value me, respect me. She's not going to feel this, like, oppressive energy. She's just going to feel loved, you know? And when people feel loved, they're so accommodating, you know? They're so willing to be flexible about stuff, you know? And then spontaneously appreciation comes out. You know, and then it's real appreciation. It's not appreciation that they feel like they should do, you know. So it just takes a bit more patience and a bit more self-work, you know, and not like goals-oriented, you know, now, deadline. You know, if I don't get appreciated by Friday, then rah! You know, it's like you can't strategize a family like a business, you know.
No, that's why I'm here.
Yeah, and you know, it sounds like you have good ways of thinking about things, but it's just about bringing it to your heart. Yeah, again, repeat. So like this. Yeah. Okay, then, be grateful to everyone. This is the next one. So banish the one to blame for everything, that's banishing, self-cherishing, self-grasping. Then be grateful to everyone. I would say be grateful to everyone, especially the difficult people, you know. Because it really is, they show you the gaps in your practice, you know. So you might think, wow, I really don't get angry anymore. Or, wow, I really am not so attached anymore. And then you have someone who shows you that's not the case, you know, and it's nice to be grateful. Oh, wow, look, I have so much anger still. Okay, good to know. Thank you, you know. And so you have to have a sense of humor with these points, you know, to really, when you've been caught off guard, when you've lost your path, when you've slipped off, you know, the wagon or whatever, to kind of laugh at yourself, you know, to have the space that goes, oh, there I did it again. Oh, man. You know, because then you're connecting with the human experience and the absurdity of life, you know, and it can lighten you up. And that's really what we want to do with these practices, is to hear the commonality of the human experience whenever we're the one that's done the wrong thing. You know, to not think, therefore I am so bad and worthless. We think, oh, humans, man, always do this. You know, and there's this sort of expanding outward, sort of connected feeling, rather than here's me screwing up again, and I always do, and I'm so bad, you know, because that's really the wrong idea of yourself. So, you know, being grateful to everyone because they're showing you yourself, you know, they're like, really, it's like we're walking around interacting with mirrors, you know, and so if we're finding everyone friendly and appealing, it's probably because we're in a good mood, not because they are inherently friendly and appealing, you know. They're reflecting our mood to us. So we thank them for showing us that. Okay, then the supreme method is accompanied by the four practices. The supreme method in that we're cultivating bodhicitta. And then the four practices are accumulating merit, purifying negativities, feeding the ghosts, and offering the Dharma protectors. So, you know, really, if we think about our daily life, the different things that we want it to include, you know, accumulating merit, this is sort of what we're doing throughout the day, positive actions of body, speech, and mind. You know, and you can talk about, if you know about the six perfections, you know, like generosity, patience, joyous effort, ethics, these sort of things accumulate huge amounts of merit. But really, whenever your motivation is bodhicitta and kindness, this is really giving you the good momentum that you want. So that's the first one, accumulating merit. We could call it positive momentum or you know, mental energy, positive mental energy. And the thing about this mental energy is that it builds into like a critical mass which will pop a realization. So it's just like when you were learning to read, there was repetition, 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 and then one day all words were obvious to you and you were able to sound them out, even the ones you didn't understand. There was critical mass in terms of the mental energy towards learning to read. And now it's something that's always with us. So we can do this with bodhicitta, we can do this with compassion, we can do this with love. With enough repetition, that critical mass builds up internally and becomes a realization. So, you know, when you were 5 years old, your mother probably told you, treat others the way you would like to be treated. And you sort of did that so you wouldn't get in trouble. And then maybe you got a little bit older and you sort of were like, wow, people are being really mean to me, I don't like that. And you realized, oh, that's not nice, experiencing meanness. Maybe I shouldn't be mean. You know, and then you got a little older and a little older, and that thought was something woven through your life to the extent where maybe you become 18 and suddenly you have this like, ding, I should treat others the way I'd like to be treated. You know, and it's something you've known your whole life, but now suddenly the penny dropped. So this is what we talk about with merit, is that you're building up momentum, you're building up critical mass, so that things that are intellectual become intrinsic to you. Okay. So then purifying negativities, and this is the practice that we talk about is helpful at the end of the day. And to be kind of fully qualified purification, it needs these four opponent powers. So the four opponent powers are refuge, regret, remedy, and resolve. There are other translations, but I choose the ones that start with R so I can remember them. Refuge, just connecting with your spiritual path. That's the first thing you do when you sit down to purify. Just connect with, what is the purpose of my life? What are the beings that embody that? So, you know, bringing up a sense of reliance in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas or the holy beings or whatever it is that you connect with. And then what you do with regret is you're recognizing faults to be faults in terms of this day, but you're also looking at how they reflect, they're reflective of habits that you've had for a long time, from probably even beginningless time. So you're regretting what you can remember, but you're also assuming there's been much of a similar type and trying to regret that as well, because then you can really purify huge amounts at one go. So if you're having trouble remembering what the day contained, you can get more specific and think first, okay, negativities of body. What did I do physically that was not on? And you can think of the classic non-virtues, you know, was there any killing karma involved? Was there any stealing karma involved? Was there any sexual misconduct involved? You kind of check through the day. You're like, okay, yep, I was okay. And then you think about, okay, in terms of my speech, you know, could I have been a bit better? So you think, okay, well, the worst type of speech negativity is lying with a poor motivation. But also, was I divisive? You know, did I say something to one person about someone else that would make them have a bad opinion about them? even if it was true, right? Was I divisive? Was I harsh in my speech? You know, could I have said things more kindly? And then the last one is idle speech or gossip. So was I speaking with attachment in order to waste time? Did I do that today? Now, you know, people could get too fundamentalist about this and think they can never talk about mundane things. But like the example I always use is my grandparents. I always talk about the weather with my grandparents because it puts them at ease, because that's a comfortable topic that makes them happy. So talking about the weather with my grandparents is not idle speech. But talking about it with maybe you guys would be, because it's just kind of indulgent and it's just kind of time wasting. So there might be like, you know, 5 minutes is fine because we're trying to like strategize what to do about the weather. But then if it just keeps going and going and going, that becomes idle speech. So idle speech is not that heavy a karma, but it becomes heavy because of how often we do it. And the same is true with all negativities. You know, the little things are little, but they become big because of how often we do them. So you just check through the day, how did my speech go? And then at the end, you really think, okay, well, what about my mind? What was my mind up to? Was it full of anger, irritability, annoyance? Was it full of attachment, craving, covetousness? You know, was I just all day craving this one thing and it was just consuming me all day? You know, what was going on with my mind? And were there some wrong views involved? Did I forget that positive actions lead to positive effects, that negative actions lead to suffering? Did I forget that during the day and really go against that way of thinking? So wrong views of that type. But mainly the first two are the ones you want to be looking at, because we don't usually have huge wrong views that we're reinforcing all throughout the day, although that could happen sometimes. But, you know, hatred and covetousness in mild, moderate, extreme forms, in some form, they're probably going to pop up throughout the day. So it's just kind of good to look at, wow, I was so irritable and it made me really standoffish and cold to so-and-so. You know, you might not have said anything, you might not have done anything, but your mind was really full of ill will, and on the basis of that, the energy around you was not nice and probably had a negative effect on someone else. You know, so you just go through recognizing faults to be faults with the understanding that these are just habits and things you can remove. So don't let yourself fall into, you know, guilt and shame and those sort of things, because that's not helpful and it's not true. And then you apply a remedy. So this is the nice part, where you're just flushing yourself clean of those negativities. So you can either do a formulaic way, like the Vajrasattva mantra, or you can make a plan to do a countermeasure. So say, you know, you were in a hurry and you were cleaning the kitchen and there were ants all over the counter and you just lost mindfulness and you were like, who cares, I'm killing them. You know, hopefully you wouldn't do that, but it could happen, right? And you just wiped up all the ants and chucked them in the rubbish. So you have some killing karma there. What's a remedy? Saving life. So you could think, maybe I'm going to go past the store on my way home and buy some bait worms and let them go. You know, you've just saved life. Countermeasure, remedy. You know, so something simple. You don't have to make a huge song and dance about it, but it really helps if you apply a countermeasure. If you're always speaking badly about Sally, try and think of something good that you can say about her, you know? And then the resolve part is really making these goals that are reasonable and time-specific, ways you can stop doing these negativities in the future. So you can't say to yourself, I'm never ever gossiping again, you know, because that's unrealistic and we don't have enough mindfulness to stay on top of that. But we could say, tomorrow at the water cooler in the morning, I'm not going to gossip. You know, so it's very specific, and you can sort of see a scenario that's going to happen tomorrow and really make a plan for it. And the next morning, hopefully you can kind of remember your resolutions. So just think, okay, I really am making a point to not gossip for that first bit when I first get to work. You know, I might lose mindfulness as the day goes on, but I'm going to really commit to not gossiping for that first hour. So, you know, it's really important that you're not overly ambitious and think that you're sort of able to do more than you can, because you'll disappoint yourself, you'll get disheartened, and then you'll give up. So that's what will happen if you're overly ambitious. But so once you've made your resolution, then drop it. You know, those faults that you've done that day, those faults that have been reflected from beginningless time, think, okay, clean slate, you know, drop it, let it go, don't hang on to it, you've purified it, you know, let it go. It's not going to bring the result of suffering now, you've burnt that seed. And to really purify, you need to let it go. So this is so different to guilt. You know, with purification, you've seen the faults of your fault and you've decided not to do it again for at least a short period of time. You're interrupting that momentum and continuity of that particular behavior. And that is worth celebrating, because how different is that to the way that you've lived your life up until now? You know, it's amazing anytime you say to yourself, I'm going to try and stop that habit. Like, it's epic how few people have the awareness of their faults that they actually try and counter them. Like, it's a rare thing in the world. So even if it's something small, it's really worth celebrating. You know, you're coming closer to your true nature. Like, hooray! You know, so really be happy at the end of your purification practice. So those two. And then the last two are feeding the ghosts and offering to the Dharma protectors. Now, feeding the ghosts, you can see as internal sort of obstacles arising in your mind, you know, that are yours, or you can see them as external things that are actually trying to pull you off course. So either way, and there's a cool passage here by Pema Chodron about them. So, Overcoming Resistance chapter, she says, feeding the ghosts, this involves relating to your unreasonableness. The way you relate to it is making a relationship with it. Traditionally, you make a little torma or a little cake and you offer it. This sudden unreasonableness that comes out of nowhere is called a din in Tibetan, and it wakes you up, and you should regard it as good, not something to get rid of. So really what you're saying is, anytime I've been pulled off my path, that's a wake-up call that I've lost my mindfulness. And so instead of saying, you obstacles go away, I'm actually saying, welcome, thank you for waking me up, and what's more, here's cake. You know, so whether it's internal stuff that's you in your mind or whether it's external obstacles, you know, it's you're sort of saying to the obstacles, thank you for reminding me that I lost mindfulness. Yeah, and then offering to the Dharma protectors. Dharma protectors can be seen as your internal qualities or external, either worldly deities or enlightened beings that are supportive to practice. So before we start retreat, we often make a lot of prayers to the Dharma protectors to help keep the area that we're doing retreat in conducive to retreat. So not that, you know, that the retreat space is somehow peaceful and amazing, but that any sort of disruptions that do come are things that we're able to take on the path and not so extreme that they're going to throw us out of our retreat. So offerings to the Dharma protectors. So these four. And if you can at least start with the first two, that's an excellent practice to be having. Just throughout your day, trying to accumulate merit. At the end of the day, doing something purifying, even if it's just a gentle reflection while you're drinking a cup of tea. All of that is going to really help your practice have momentum. So that's this one. And the last point is apply meditation immediately at every opportunity. And that means really what it says. Whenever you've lost mindfulness, whenever you've got space and time, whenever there's a little pocket in your day where you can sit for 2 minutes, try, because it'll just keep you on the path. So that's that one. And after lunch, we'll do number 4.